We're taking up the study of Shemos. In Parshas Bo. In Parshas Bo, in the encounter between Moshe and Paro. So, you can see that there's a certain amount of development going on. And that as the plagues get stronger and stronger, it seems as though Paro at certain times is about to give in. In fact, he does. He acknowledges God, and at one point he is prepared to give Moshe permission, but there's always snags, as we see. For example, when's the first time that he accepts the idea that he's willing to let them go? In the case when Moshe threatens to bring down the Arbe, that's the locust, that's in chapter 10, and that's after the devastation of the hail, the Barad. So Moshe gives him a warning as to the severity of what's going to happen. That they're going to consume whatever was left over from the hail. And they're going to eat all of the trees and everything that grows in the field. And so on. So at this point in time, this is in chapter 10, verse 7, the Avdei Paro, the servants of Paro, speak up. They apparently at this point have seen the reality. For how long will this be a stumbling block? Send out the men and let them serve the Lord their God. Haterem Tedak Yavda Mitzrayim. Don't you already know that Egypt is lost? So it seems that the servants of Paro had a clear picture. The hardening of the heart is something which applied to Paro. But you see, at this then it says that they brought back Moshe and Aaron. This is the first time this happened, that Moshe came and he left. Moshe gave them the warning and he left. It's interesting to note, why does the Torah have to point that out? But bear that in mind, because we're going to see a similar thing coming up soon, which is really what I want to focus on. Verse 6, after Moshe concludes his statement, his warning, it says, Vayifen Vayetze Me'imparo. He turned and went out from before Paro. That seemingly would be redundant. Why does the Chumash have to tell you that? The Torah doesn't go into those kinds of details. Obviously, he didn't stay there. He came for the meeting, and then he left. So it doesn't have to tell me that he left. So there must be some significance to that. But it's interesting to note that the servants of Paro continue the discussion. They don't want this to happen. Now they've tasted enough of the bad medicine, and they want to prevent it. So they bring back Moshe and Aaron. And he said to them, go and serve the Lord your God. So now he's giving them permission. Miva miha holchem. Who's going? Who do you intend to take with you? So then Moshe said, we're going, this is the famous statement, bin arenu v'zkeneinu nelech. We're going with our youth and with our elders, with our children, with our sons and daughters, and with our sheep and our oxen, because it is a holiday, a festival to the Lord. So Paro reacts to that. And he says it's not a good idea to take the children. Lochein, lechuna hagvarim. He's saying it's too dangerous, doesn't make sense to go out into the wilderness with the children. He didn't accept the idea of the children going along with them. Which on the surface you could understand that. That is that the adults are the ones, the men basically, Hagvarim, the adults. That's the way it appeared to Paro, that the religious obligations were discharged by the men, essentially. And you leave the children behind. And the women, of course, have to take care of the children, so they stay behind too. Let the men go and serve Hashem, because that's what you're searching for. And, I'm sorry. Well, kiyosa atem mevakshim, because that is what you're asking for. Rashi says, kiyosa bikashtem adheno, because that was your request. There's an additional element here in that Paro was saying to them that I'm giving in to your request, and that's all you requested. You never requested anything about the children. Because you always said, Nizbucha le'elokeinu, let us sacrifice to our God. V'ein derech hataf lizbach. It's not the nature that children sacrifice. As far as that's concerned, it would seem that Parah was correct. He seems to have a legitimate point that why are you bringing in the children over here? The Ibn Ezra says that Parah thought that they intend to run away. So that's a refrain over here. Apparently Parah was suspicious that this was just a ploy. In fact, at the very outset, when he responded to them, he increased the labor. The Ibn Ezra adds another point. There's some general issues pertaining to the whole way in which, you know, Moshe, the Jews, related to the Egyptians. That, for example, we've discussed some of them. The fact, did they use deception with the Egyptians? The Jews have been accused of deception. Did they borrow? Did they ask to borrow the jewelry and the clothing, and then they never returned them? That's one. And also, were they being deceptive in the entire request? The very request was for 3 days, but in point of fact, they never came back. So was that a lie? Were they? And if so, that's an issue. I mean, you can say, well, maybe you're permitted to lie in that situation, but that has to be established. But the Ibn Ezra points out, he says, no, that our master Moshe never told Paro that he was going to return so that you could accuse Moshe of being a liar. He only said that he would go a distance of 3 days. And that's all he said. This is a very important point. And it was the Egyptians thought that he would return. And that's why they loaned them. They gave them their jewelry. That is, according to the Ibn Ezra, when they gave it, they assumed it was going to be returned. That's the whole question. The word she'ela means request, but it has the sense of being borrowing. So that's an entire discussion. Did the Jews ask to borrow the jewelry and with the idea that they would return it, in which case the Egyptians gave it to them only because they thought they'd get it back? Or did the Jews ask it for an outright gift? If they asked for an outright gift, so then you don't have the issue that they stole from them. But if they asked to borrow, obviously if I borrow something from you and then I don't return it, so then that's theft. So he's saying, the Ibn Ezra, that the Egyptians drew their own conclusions that the Jews were going to return. But you can't accuse Moshe of lying because he never said he was coming back. Of course, one can say that even according to the Ibn Ezra, but you're still implying by saying you're going a distance of 3 days. The implication is that you're going to come back. So why don't you make it clear if you're coming back or not? But I don't have a problem with that. Because the Jews were under no obligation to come back into slavery. The Egyptians were the ones who were acting oppressively. So they enslaved the Jews. Their enslavement was obviously a tremendous injustice. And the Jews, if somebody imprisons you, if somebody kidnaps you, if somebody tortures you and imprisons you, and you're trying to escape, and you ask for permission to go to the bathroom or something like that, as though that's all you're going to do, then you're going to come back, and the person gives you the permission, and then you sneak out, you didn't do anything wrong. First of all, you're allowed to lie in a situation like that. It's interesting that you're allowed to lie in a situation like that, but the Ibn Ezra is not saying that. He's saying that Moshe didn't lie. It would appear that's significant, that it would not be correct for Moshe to lie. But to do what he did means that's very brilliant diplomacy. Very brilliant diplomacy. Of course, we don't know what would happen if Paro would have challenged him. So Paro didn't challenge him. on that and say, well, what do you mean? Are you coming back afterwards? And Moshe said, yeah, I'm coming back. That did not happen. Moshe did not give his word. According to the Ebenezer, Moshe never gave his word. So I'm just asking for permission to leave. And what would have happened if he asked Moshe? I don't know. But I'm certainly not obligated to tell you. I am not obligated to do more. That's a very good explanation. Given that Moshe and the Jews didn't have to be there in the first place, given that they had every right to leave against the will of the Egyptians, so I'm not so sure why, again, as I say, I'm not so sure why the Torah is not, well, I mean, it didn't happen that way, but the Ebenezer seems to be saying that it wouldn't have been appropriate for Moshe to lie. My question is why? Let's say he would have had to lie. Let's say Paro would have asked him, for example, are you coming back? I'm not sure. There's two possibilities. I mean, it's possible that for some reason that wouldn't have been correct. Although I don't see why. If you ask me, did the Jews have a right to lie in this situation? I would say yes. To obtain your freedom, of course you have a right to lie. When somebody is acting in an unjust way against you, then you have a right to defend yourself in every way possible. The other person loses their right. You don't owe them. You don't owe them anything in terms of truth to enable them to do something oppressive. That's absurd. So clearly you have a right to lie. So that can't be the reason. It might be, however, that the Torah did not want to depict Moshe that way because of the effect that it has on the reader. That is to say, not everything... The Torah takes into consideration the level of the reader, and that's why you have to be very, very careful. Certain things it's not going to make public. Even though there's nothing wrong with them, but people look at it that way. People wouldn't understand, so perhaps that's the reason. Yeah. We've already discussed the issue of the way the Torah depicts the heroes, the behavior of the heroes. And it's not going to limit itself just to those things that everybody's going to like. It will present them as doing certain things that are challenging, that we can't understand, because it's trying to elevate us to a higher level. That means that we're operating with certain concepts. However, those concepts are not necessarily true. And you have to be able to revise them. And therefore, to accept certain behaviors which, at first glance, may be repugnant to you, because you don't understand it, and you're operating with a certain emotionalistic type of morality. However, there's a limit to what the Torah is going to do. The Torah is not going to depict certain things which might be too challenging. Now, I think a good example we had, getting back to Bereishis, was the fact that when the Torah depicts the narrative of the brothers' assail, the sale of Yosef, it doesn't bring out the full drama. As we know, Yosef was pleading profusely with them for mercy, and they were hard, they were cold to him. You wouldn't know that from reading the story itself. It doesn't mention Yosef as doing anything. Yosef doesn't have a talking part in that part of the story. It just tells you what the brothers did and what they debated and what they changed. But later on, when they're being mistreated in Egypt and they don't know why and they believe it has to do, they start to review the past. And then they say, Reuven went further. But they said that we're guilty concerning our brother, Yosef. They meant Yosef. And that we saw his suffering when he pleaded with us, and we didn't listen, and therefore this has come upon us. So now we discover that there was a lot of drama, that Yosef was pleading, and they were hard-hearted. But the Torah didn't. The Torah only allows us to get this through retrospect. When they're in the process, the brothers are in the process of doing tshuva, and they mention it. But it does not depict them actually in that situation itself, directly. So that's an important point. Then it says, Vayagoresh Osam Eis Pnei Paro, that he drove them away. Vayagoresh, so he pretty much, this is pretty harsh, it sounds like he Vayagoresh, like he kicked them out. That Yosef, Paro just dismissed them. And then, the next thing, of course, you have the makeh, the plague of the locust. Now, as a result of that, Paro calls them back. Now, if you go to 16, that's 10:16. Paro hurried to call Moshe and Aaron, and he said, Chatasi let Hashem Elokeichem v'lachem. I've sinned against the Lord your God and you. So this seems to be a major development for Paro, that he's acknowledging that he sinned. He sinned before God, and he sinned before Moshe. And now please bear my sin just this time and entreat the Lord your God that he should remove from me only this evil, this maves, this death. So he apparently again was brought down. He was extremely humbled by the locust, and he pleads with him. And Moshe doesn't force the issue. He does as he says. He left Paro and he entreated God. And then God caused this mighty wind from the sea, very powerful, to carry the locust and deposited them in the Yamsuf. And there did not remain even one locust in the entire boundary of Egypt. And then, of course, God hardened the heart of Paro, and he didn't send. He didn't send the Jews. You have the Choshech. The Choshech is the last of the plagues, except for the tenth. The killing of the firstborn is not a typical plague. It has a different effect. So really, there are nine plagues. Then you have the destruction of the firstborn. So then it goes on to describe the Choshech. Now what happens then? Let's take a look. After, this is in chapter 10, after describing the power, the effect of the darkness, it was a thick darkness. It wasn't just an absence of light that they couldn't see. They couldn't move. That's how thick it was. So now in chapter 10, verse 24, so Paro called Moshe and said, go and serve Hashem. So now he's made this is the second time he makes this concession, and he's giving them permission to leave. But, so he's conceding with regard to the children, as we'll see. Because Moshe Rabbeinu had said that we're going together with our children and together with our animals. So there must have been a reason why he mentioned animals. He knew that there was a sore spot. But Paro says, but only your sheep and your cattle shall remain, that don't take them with you, but gam tapchem yelech imachem. Your children can go with you. So that's a major concession. So in the first instance, he became stubborn because of the request for the children. He denied the request for the children. Now, it's a big step forward for Paro. He's letting him take the children, but not the animals. So let's take a look at the response of Moshe. Vayomer Moshe. Moshe said, Gamata titein biyodeinu zvachim v'yolos. You too will place in our hands sacrifices and burnt offerings, and we shall bring them to the Lord our God. V'gam mikneinu yelech imanu. And also our cattle will go with us. We will not leave behind a hoof, because from it we will take to serve the Lord our God. And we don't know with what. We don't know what the service will be until we get there. So basically, this is the answer of Moshe. It's a very interesting kind of an answer. And that is, he rejects what he's saying. He's saying we're going with our children, of course. That's already been settled. But we're also going with our cattle, and we're taking it all with us. Not even one, not hoof, not one hoof. So, I mean, let's pause and analyze that for a second. What kind of a position is that? That you're going to need everything you have? That's very interesting. On a certain level, if you can ask which is... Well, neither position is... Paro's position is not reasonable either. Because what do you leave it behind? The whole point of going out there is to serve God. So we have to take some. Now, I'm not sure whether Paro was forbidding taking anything, or Paro just started off by saying, we don't know. He just started off by saying you can't take anything, and then Moshe would have argued, and maybe Paro would have conceded to let them take some, but that doesn't happen because Moshe says we're taking everything. Now let's continue for a bit over here. I just want, as I said, the position of Moshe, at least at first glance, that also doesn't seem to make sense. Because it is reasonable, if I came back and I said, okay, we'll let you take the animals that you need for the sacrifice, for the festival, and you tell me we have to take everything, because we don't know. I mean, that seems a little bit strange. I mean, there should be a certain estimate of what you're going to need. But Moshe doesn't say that. Moshe says that we have to take everything. The implication, I guess, is that we may have to use everything. But of course, you could see how it's catering to Paro's emotions that he's being taken for a ride over here. This is a trick. You're taking all of your children, you're taking everything, and for a supposedly just to observe a festival to your God, and then you're going to come back? That sounds very strange. What happens next, though? Then it says that God hardened his heart. So the hardening of the heart is significant. Why does it have to mention over here that God hardened the heart and he refused to send them? Why doesn't it simply say that he refused to send them? Because he suspected him. He didn't want to give in. That's why. What's the reason? It seems from the story that the reason that he didn't send them is because he didn't want to give in to such a request. That they should take everything with them. Yet, the Pasuk says that God hardened his heart and he didn't want to. So was it because of the hardening of the heart or was it because of the disagreement, the terms that Moshe wanted? It means, the Torah is really pointing out over here the true state of Paro. And that is to say that, of course, Paro did not want them to take the animals. However, the fear of the Makos, of the plagues, was so great that he would have given in to this request. If Paro, let's take it according to the Rambam, that without this hardening of the heart, or either way, if you want to take a look at this one, it doesn't make any sense. Without the hardening of the heart, left to his own devices, even though he lost that round, even though Moshe was demanding everything, and Paro didn't want to do it, but Paro would have done it. He would have done it because he didn't want to go through another plague. But God hardened his heart. So with the hardening of the heart, and then of course, it's interesting. Let's say, however, that Moshe would have agreed with him to leave the animals behind. It would seem that it doesn't make any difference. That according to the Rambam, God had taken away his free will. Paro was not going to let them go of his own volition. Now the Torah continues with what goes on. It says that Paro said to him, Lech me'olai. Leave, go away from me. Okay, he's dismissed him before, but this is not an ordinary dismissal. What happens next is something which is unprecedented. Guard yourself. Do not see my face again. For on the day that you see my face, you will die. This is something which is completely new. Because up until now, there's no indication of Paro even getting angry with him. Or of Paro threatening him. That's an amazing thing, as we've said. The fact is that here was Moshe Rabbeinu coming to negotiate on behalf of the Jews and bringing down these plagues upon him. At no point does Paro take any action against him personally. Doesn't kill him or anything like that. Doesn't imprison him. Moshe has this total freedom to come and go. And Paro is respectful. Here, something different occurs, that Paro says, leave, and he threatens him with death. And the Moshe says, Kain dibarta, okay, you're fine. You've spoken correctly. I will not see your face anymore. Now, what happens next? Is it true that Moshe did not see Paro again? Is that true? We know that he communicated with him. Because if you take a look at chapter 11, verse 4, it says, Moshe said, Thus says Hashem, at midnight I will go forth in the land of Egypt, and every book, the every firstborn will die, and so on and so forth. Who did Moshe tell this to? Obviously, he told it to Paro. So what happened? Moshe had just accepted the fact that he will not see him again. And yet here he is talking to him about the, giving him the warning about the firstborn. All right? So like the Mepharshim explained, chapter 11, let's go back to the beginning of chapter 11. Right after Moshe says, you're right, I won't see your face again. Then it says that Hashem said to Moshe, I'm going to bring one further plague on Paro and on Egypt. Afterwards, he will send you out. And when he sends you out, he will drive you completely away from here. In my opinion, this pasuk itself is saying that Paro didn't, when Paro finally let them go, he didn't let them go for 3 days, he just drove them out. Because of the pressure of the Makas Bechoras. That's what it says. That's what it seems to mean. That he'll drive you out. I don't know when he drives them out that he expects them to come back. Anyways, where was Moshe? When did this communication occur? And how does Moshe go back to Paro, seemingly go back to Paro and tell him this? So then Hashem says, speak in the ear of the people. That there's where the command is given. That each man shall ask his friend, and each woman shall ask her friend for vessels of silver and gold. And then it says that God established the favor of the nation in the eyes of Egypt. Also the man Moshe was exceedingly great in the land of Egypt, in the eyes of the servants of Paro, and in the eyes of the nation. So now the Torah is giving us a clue that during the course of this year, when God had brought the plagues on Egypt, so a tremendous transformation occurred. This is also contrary to our ordinary expectation. You'd have thought that they would hate the Jews. It's an amazing idea. You would have thought that they would hate the Jews, but to the contrary, the Jews became objects of great estimation and veneration. And the man Moshe, who was responsible for all the suffering they were going through, they became a tremendously significant figure in the eyes of the servants of Paro. Obviously, it omits Paro himself. That's always a good question. But what's going on over here? What about that issue of don't see my face anymore? Well, let's continue. Then it says that Moshe... So, the Mepharshim say that what took place was that this Nevuah, that this prophecy that Moshe received takes place while Moshe is before Paro. He doesn't leave. It doesn't say that he leaves. Paro warns him not to see him again. Moshe says, fine, I won't see you again, and does not leave. And right at that point, he receives the prophecy, this message from Hashem about the final plague, which is the Makas Bechoros. And then, before he leaves, he communicates it. So it's all one session, so to speak. So then Moshe says that this is what God says. At midnight, I'm going to go forth in the land of Egypt, and every firstborn will die. Whether from the Bechor of Paro, Paro's own. So he's warning him personally that Paro will suffer from this personally. And down to the lowest one, the firstborn of the slave, and the firstborn of the animal. And there'll be a great scream in the entire land of Egypt that the likes of it has never happened before, and the likes of it will never happen again. However, for all of the children of Israel, a dog will not even snarl. Whether it be against man or animal, in order that you will know how God differentiates between Egypt and between Israel. And he continues, and all of your servants, these servants will come down to me and bow down to me. That is, Moshe will be in complete charge, begging me, saying, Tzayata v'cholam, leave. V'yachre k'enetze, and afterwards I'll go. Afterwards I'll go. It means he's not going to go immediately. There'll be, because that was during the nighttime, he leaves in the morning, in a organized fashion, not like slaves in the night. But what happens next? What's the last words in that verse? Vayetze Me'im Paro b'chariyaf. And he walked away from Paro with blazing anger. Who's Moshe did. Now that always bothered me. What's the idea of the anger? Why did Moshe get angry? Why did Moshe get angry over here? Against Paro. And what's the nature of that anger? As we've learned many times, was he really angry? And Rashi says, B'chariyaf, Al sha'amar lo, because he said to him, Al tosef ro'os panai. Do not see my face anymore. That's not so easy to comprehend, because when he said that, Moshe's response was, Kein dibarta. Seems that he was okay with it. And why would it bother him? Why would he get angry? Well, Moshe wanted to see him. Now, the Rambam says that we've learned this concept many times, that there, generally speaking, all of the various emotional dispositions should be in between. You shouldn't go to either extreme, but rather in the area of moderation. However, there's two exceptions. There's the exception of anger. Anger, the Rambam says, that a person should not partake of anger even to a slight extent. And ego. Ego. That if, when it comes to humbleness, a person should go to the extreme of humbleness, not partake of the emotion of ego at all. Should utterly uproot it from his soul. And the same is true with anger. That a person should... because you might think that a person could be angry in moderation. That's not unreasonable. Most people would... if you ask most people about anger, intelligent people, rational people, what's a rational position? You know, anger management. So that, yeah, anger management. That is, if a person's getting angry over trivial things, and the extent of the anger is not in line with the situation, small things, you can't even talk to the person, he goes crazy, he has a temper. So that's a problem. But if the person has the anger under control, then there are certain situations where it's perfectly legitimate, where people take advantage of you, or do other things that are terrible, and you should get angry. In fact, they would say to go to the other extreme of uprooting anger completely, that would seem to be absurd to most people. Yet that's what the Rambam says. But of course he says, as you know, that there's situations where you have to. When you're raising children or other situations, sometimes the teacher has to get angry. The students have to feel anger. That's an important factor. So he says, in that case, you display anger. The perfected individual will not get angry in that case. It's amazing. Even for something which warrants anger, he will not get angry. It warrants. So what does it mean, it warrants? It means that he's in complete control of the situation. And it's really play acting, so to speak. He's displaying. He can demonstrate anger intelligently. Because the kids or the students have to feel the anger. But he himself, within himself, in his own heart, in his own mind, he's not feeling angry. A good question can be raised, but it's sort of a contradiction, because you're supposed to be a role model. And if the ideal of the role model is someone that doesn't get angry, so then if when you display anger and the child doesn't know you're displaying, he thinks that it's real. But aren't you caught in a contradiction? That on the one hand you have to do it because the child needs the anger. On the other hand, you're teaching the child that it's appropriate to be angry under certain circumstances when that's not the ultimate ideal. The answer to that question is that it's an impossibility to do otherwise. It's sort of like the idea of learning Torah for its own sake, as opposed to learning for a reward. Of course, the ultimate goal is to learn Torah for its own sake, but it's impossible in training someone that you start off that way. It's an impossibility. So you have to get to that level. The same would be with this over here, that it's enough. I mean, step one, you have to get the child to do the right thing. You have to control him or he'll destroy himself, whatever the case is. So that if your anger is in accordance with real things they ought not to be doing, So, and that's the only way to stop them. So that's essential at this point in time. And afterwards, they'll see that you're not a crazy person that gets angry over crazy things. Okay? Then, if they reach the appropriate level of instruction, so then you could even teach them the concept that they shouldn't really get angry, but they can display anger. But that's something that they're not ready for until an advanced state. And you're not going to get them to that advanced state unless you facilitate that control over their instincts. So you have to control their instincts. So that's, I guess, if you want to use the term necessary evil, I don't know. It's sort of the same, it's a similar idea. If you're not going to offer the child rewards for studying Torah, he's not going to study Torah. So that's a necessary procedure. It's a necessary step. So two, the child receiving anger from you in order to control, to check his instincts is absolutely essential. It may be necessary to hit the child at certain points because it's absolutely essential that he gain control over his instincts. At that point in time, it doesn't matter that there's a message that anger is okay. That's irrelevant. He's not ready for that teaching yet. Okay. The anger of Moshe to Paro, what kind of an anger was it?
Was he
really angry? If he was really angry, then Moshe is a model, a role model, why would he be really angry? And if it wasn't, it was a display, why was he suddenly displaying the anger at Paro? The meaning is he displayed it. He walked out in a huff. He walked out in it with that blazing anger. That's what it means. It was for Paro. Vayetzemi and Paro b'chari yaf. He walked out that Paro knew that Moshe was angry at him. Just to get the order straight, Paro starts, antagonizes Moshe, if you will, as a response to the discussion about the animals. That Paro said you should leave the animals behind. You could take the children. And Moshe rejects that idea with his answer that we don't know. We have to take everything with us. That's when Paro gets upset, if you will. Yeah, that's when he gets upset with him and tells him that that's it. Don't see my face anymore.
But why is this thing yes?
Then what happens next is Moshe does not leave. Because Moshe at that point gets the prophecy about the slaying of the firstborn. Okay, then Moshe communicates that prophecy, and as he's in the process of leaving, he displays this burning anger. Let's go back to the exchange between Moshe and Paro in chapter 10, verse 25. When Paro says that go and serve your God, but only leave your animals behind, you can take your children with you. Moshe's response, there's two psukim over there. What do we need, Pasuk 25? Basically, the answer is in 26, we're going to take our animals with us. We're not going to leave behind because we don't know. What does he mean when he said, when Moshe says, you too will give, will place in our hands sacrifices and burnt offerings, and we will bring them to the Lord our God. What's he talking about? What's he saying? Was that a prediction that you too? Well, what do you mean by that? So, what we're trying to understand is, what is it that triggered the reaction of Paro? What triggered the reaction of Paro? Paro, up until this point, did not have this kind of a reaction. In the last case, it said by a Goresh, that he drove them away. Okay, that's a little bit harsh, but he didn't say don't come back. This time, Paro has a very harsh reaction. 28. And Paro said to him, Lech me'olai, go away from me and guard yourself. Do not see my face again, because I will kill you. Basically, he's threatening to kill him. It's interesting, because he's not going to kill him now, but if I see you again, I'll kill you. Stay away from me. What triggered that? He never said that before, to stay away from me. Now, let's go back at the exchange. It would seem, is it the statement of Moshe that we're going to take our animals with us? Because we don't know what God will demand until we get there? Is that? Because Moshe makes two statements, 25 and 26. Which of the two triggers the reaction of Paro? Ask ourselves about 25, where Moshe seems to be saying that you too will give us animals for sacrifices. But is that true? Did he just make that up? Did it actually happen? Where do we see later on that that happened? That, is that true? That Paro, when he came that night, or through his messengers, and let's take a look what happens on the night of the slaying of the firstborn. That actual verse is on chapter 12, 32. Actually, it's 31. It says that he called for Moshe and Aaron at night. And he said, now this, if you take this literally, it's the Paro called and spoke to them. So in point of fact, he didn't keep his vow that he would kill him. It never happened. Unless we take this to mean a messenger. And he said, get up and get out from amongst my nation. Also you, also the children of Israel, and go and serve Hashem as you've said, your terms, according to your terms. Also your sheep, also your cattle, take with you, as you said, and go, and bless also me. Now, Verachtem Gamosi, bless also me. So Rashi says that means pray for me that I won't die, because I'm a firstborn. The Eben Ezra, however, does say, take a look at the Eben Ezra, Uverachtem Gamosi, he said, what does that mean that you should bless me too? That you should bless me and pray. That he wanted him to bless him and pray for him. And also, that he gave, it also means that he gave him sacrifices, as Moshe had said. So it's interesting, the Eben Ezra learns that what Moshe was saying was a prediction. That he was telling him that you too will give sacrifices. And if so, then it had to happen. It was a prophecy. And indeed, the Eben Ezra says that that's included in the idea of bless me too. That is, pray for me too. And here's the animals. Although the verse doesn't say that he's telling him, but we can deduce, says the Eben Ezra, that he did. But what got Paro upset? Why would that get Paro upset, that statement? If anything, you would think the statement, the other statement, when Moshe refuses and he says, I'm taking all the animals with me, okay, maybe that got him upset. But why would verse 25? I happen to think it's verse 25. Take a look at Rashi. If we go back to 25, you too will give. Rashi doesn't learn it, that it's a prediction of what's going to happen. Oh, the Eben Ezra. The Eben Ezra, interestingly enough, on verse 25, takes it to mean as follows. Not saying that you two will give. Gam ata chayev litein biyadenu. You two are obligated to give in our hands sacrifices and burnt offerings to sacrifice for you, for your sake. It's kind of like, kind of like something I'm involved in, debate I'm involved in. Like today, throughout history, the Christianity always maintained that Judaism was finished, was canceled. That the covenant between God and the Jews was canceled, and they're the new chosen people. That in order to be, you know, to be the religion, they had to say that. Even though it's completely false, but because if the Torah is true and the Torah is binding, so how can you have Christianity? So that was always their theology. And recently, in the last 25 years or so, the new doctrine, after the Holocaust, the new doctrine of the church was that, no, the Jews have a valid covenant. The Jews are legitimate. So then I always say, one second, you can't leave it at that. If that's the case, if ours is legitimate, so you have to take the next logical step, so yours is false. And you have to acknowledge the fact that you established something where there's no basis for it, because if the old covenant is the correct one, that's eternal. That's for all of mankind. It can't be changed. So now you're acknowledging that. But they don't want to have it that way. They want to have it both ways, which is illogical. Similarly, over here, Paro had just recognized their right to serve God. Okay, go ahead. I'm recognizing your right to serve God. Go and serve your God. This is a tremendous... That was the whole debate. That was the entire debate between Moshe and Paro, which Paro started off by saying, who is God that I should listen to him? I don't know God, and I'm also not going to send the Jews. I mean, he was denying the whole thing. This whole idea is absolute nonsense. He was denying their religion. It wasn't just that a political play. It was more than that. It was a whole theological debate. This whole thing is absolute nonsense. So now, Paro is coming with this tremendous concession that I'm letting you go and sacrifice God. Moshe Rabbeinu did not play it as a politician. Politically, he could have played it differently. Politically, he could have simply said, we have to take some animals or whatever the case may be. But he went further. He says, no. You too, it's not enough for you just to recognize that this is our thing. It's a universal religion. This is a universal religion, and you, well, you can understand, they worship the sheep. We know that from the Torah itself, that that's what Moshe said, we can't sacrifice sheep. The whole idea was to uproot the idolatry. But it's not just for us. You too have to uproot idolatry and acknowledge the true God. That's the meaning. You're chayiv to give just like we are. That's what Paro got angry, in my opinion. Well, that he couldn't take. It's one thing, you see, people. That's why people can't engage in religious dialogue. It's very, very difficult unless you agree with those people that are advocating religious dialogue are saying there is no religious truth, that we should all just pat each other on the back. That everybody's saying the same thing. That's absolute nonsense. To dissect somebody else's religion and to show that the whole religion is false. You see, mankind is not on that level. That's why all the wars in the world today, one way or another, go back to religion, religious belief. People are crazy. They're insane when it comes to religious belief. They can't be rational about it. So in my opinion, this is what triggered off. If Paro got angry at him, chutzpah, not only I'm acknowledging his religion, he's telling me that my religion is nonsense, that I have to take sheep and offer them to God. But that's what Moshe Rabbeinu told him. And you see, Moshe Rabbeinu was not interested in diplomacy. Now, in my opinion, that's what Moshe is reacting to. That is, the Rambam says that charonaf, those very same words, that burning anger, Hashem, that Hashem is not, you know, the anthropomorphisms that are permitted to be associated with God. That's a very, very touchy subject, very delicate. So to depict God as angry is getting too close to the physical, to the emotional. But God, the Torah does depict God, charonaf, that God will, you see, that's why it's necessary for people to hear that. With regard to the worst sin of all, the sin of idolatry. So the Rambam says that the only time the Torah uses, depicts God as burning anger is with regard to the sin of idolatry. So that's what I think is the idea. That Moshe Rabbeinu assumed the role of being a mentor to Paro. He was trying to guide Paro, to elevate Paro, to teach Paro. Whether Paro had the freedom or didn't have the freedom, it doesn't matter, because that was the purpose of the, if according to the Rambam, the purpose was to show that when God takes away a person's freedom, there's nothing in the world that can help them. But then, so you're seeing, look at all the instruction. He got the instruction. So it was necessary for Moshe to display charonaf, burning anger, at that point. That was the correct, that was the appropriate response because of the factor of idolatry. That Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to wean him away from idolatry. And when he said, maybe it's in line with Rashi, when he said that don't see me anymore, that meant that that's it. He's not going to break away from idolatry. So that, he deserved the display of burning anger. The Rambam is coming at this from the vantage point that Paro really didn't have free will. So of course, what's the point of going through all the motions? That is to teach all of mankind that a person can reach such a level. And when he does so, then all the reason in the world won't help. But in order to show you that, the Torah has to depict. You have to show that Moshe did all the correct things that any normal, intelligent person would be moved by, and still Paro wasn't moved. But then that's necessary for Moshe to do everything that's correct. So sometimes you have to show emotion. So that's when, in this case, Moshe is displaying emotion. In my opinion, it wasn't that Moshe himself was angry. It's the anger the Rambam talks about which is permitted to display. To display in order to motivate children or students or whatever the case is when they're really not being affected by the rational message. The point of the Rambam has to be understood. When the Rambam says that it's not right It's not appropriate for a perfected person to get angry. She said, what about this other person? He's worshiping idols. Yeah, but why should you get angry? Most of the people who get angry, like religious people get angry at that other people. Look at him. He's not keeping Shabbos. He drives his car. Well, why are you so angry? Well, you're angry because of you're on such a high plane that if anything, you should feel sad for the person. He's a fool. Most of the people, most of religious anger is because they take it personally. It's an affront to them. It's based on their insecurity, and it's because they take it as a personal insult.
What if a person is really just
a perfected individual? There's no reason. What's the reason to get angry? So it's his defect. It's his corruption. So do something about it. But why do you feel emotionally angry?
It's like a fish.